Today, ACLU Legal Director is on Regionally Speaking to discuss the organization's reaction to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. We'll bring back our conversation about maternal health as the court's decision could have a devastating impact on maternal mortality rates. Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer joins us to discuss a program to help everyone plan for retirement. And we bring back our conversation with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. She recently visited the region to talk with local business leaders. All of that and more on this edition of Regionally Speaking, but first, the news.
Joining us here on Regionally Speaking is the ACLU Legal Director of Indiana, Ken Falk, to discuss the latest on the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Ken, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
So we know what's happened now at the federal level, Ken. What happens next at the state level? As of right now, Indiana... You can get an abortion legally in Indiana, but that may soon very well change. Is that correct?
There is a special session that was called before this, I think, to discuss our surplus and giving some money back. And that I assume the legislature will also want to take up abortion, although we do not know at this point.
And I know that Governor Holcomb recently announced that he is pro-life, and he would expect that the Indiana General Assembly to take a look at the federal Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. So now, for residents in Indiana, as we look forward to the future of abortion here, not only in this state but across the country. What kind of an impact does this have for women?
Well, I mean, this has a profound impact. This is a women's health issue. It's always been perceived that way, something that a woman and her doctor are able to discuss without interference from the state. Now that the Supreme Court has removed the constitutional protection, and I would add this is the first time ever that in the history of the United States that the Supreme Court has removed a right previously deemed to be fundamental. But now that that's been yanked away, then I think we're going to see in states that choose to limit or even prohibit abortions, we're going to see some rather severe health consequences. And I don't think we have to hypothesize. I think we know what life was like before Roe versus Wade in terms of women getting abortions that could be very detrimental to their health, if not fatal. To women having children that they could not take care of. Indiana does not have a very good supportive system for child care. And we're going to see that extremely stressed. We're going to see women dropping out of the job market with serious economic consequences both to them and to the economy in general because they're going to be children to be taken care of. It's going to be very... it's going to be very disruptive, and it's going to fall primarily on persons with insufficient resources to travel to Illinois to get an abortion, where abortion will be legal. It will, statistics show, will fall disproportionately on persons of color. So it's going to be very disruptive.
Speaking of persons of color, I know that we have a real problem here in Northwest Indiana, especially the northern part of Lake County, where women disproportionately die who are pregnant either during the pregnancy or when giving birth, and they tend to be minorities. And what sort of an issue or an impact is this going to have when it comes to minority women who already may not have the ease of health care or access to health care that some of their neighbors right down the road or a county over might have?
Well, I think it's, as you said, I think it's going to be profound. The interesting thing is that in polling, I believe, in Indiana, the majority of persons are against a ban, an absolute ban on abortions. And I think people are going to be surprised to see the consequences. And I don't think the Supreme Court decision takes into effect those consequences, but I think they're going to occur. And it's just a very sad day, particularly for women and for women's health. But as I said, this is a right that we've accepted for 50 years. And you can look back to the beginning of the United States, and we've never had a situation like that where the Supreme Court has said, well, you know, this is a right that is fundamental, that is encapsulated within the notion of liberty in the Constitution, but is now taken away.
And with that, I mean, we've seen legislators try to, you know, work towards, you know, gun legislation, and it's always come back to, well, the Second Amendment says this, and they want to work towards something else, and they say, well, the Constitution says this. You said it's never happened before. Does this set a precedent moving forward for other types of things that I think we kind of take for granted, the access to contraception, same-sex marriage as well?
Yep. Well, if you look at Justice Thomas's concurrence, he's in favor of revisiting that. Now, the majority, Justice Alito, says that, no, this is solely related to abortion. But I think you're right that the constitutional underpinning of the right to the former right to abortion is the same notion of liberty that has given not only ability to get contraception or same-sex marriage, but also our parental rights, our ability to discipline our children the way we see fit without interference from the state. There's nothing in the Constitution that says there's a right to family integrity, but the court has accepted that as part of due process. So we'll have to see what happens. I hope that we're talking just about abortion here, but you're perfectly right. The legal argument could be the same.
We're talking with Ken Falk, ACLU Legal Director of Indiana, here on Regionally Speaking. Ken, As we sort of, I guess, ride the shockwave of this news coming out, we saw this coming a few months ago when the leaked Supreme Court memo had, or rather the memo had been leaked out, I believe, by Politico. And we've seen some of that same rhetoric, that same language from that memo. You know, what was the thought process at the time that the memo came out, and now looking back at it today, where we, you know, was there a thought process of this isn't going to happen, or here's what the ACLU plans to do to work against it? What happens then? Or,
well, we certainly did not think it was not going to happen. Once the Chief Justice confirmed that this was actually a draft, I think it was assumed by all that it was going to happen, although I think all of us were, you know, dreading the day and hope that beyond hope that something different would happen. I think that we have been working with interested groups and persons to try and educate the legislatures as to the issues here, that this is a decision that has far-reaching health consequences for Hoosier women, and that is something that should be considered as the legislature embarks on whatever course they want to embark on. And of course, if the legislature does something differently, we'll see if there's a litigation response that's possible.
What have you heard from state lawmakers when it comes to Roe v. Wade and access to abortion in Indiana?
I mean, I've heard nothing. I do not. I don't know what's going to happen. I think that we have a Republican supermajority, and we have certain definite views about abortion. On the other hand, I think that there's a common sense, should be a common sense recognition of what removing this right for all women will do and the negative consequences that it will have, especially on a state that really does not support child care, does not support early child development, and how this will disproportionately impact Hoosier women of color and Hoosier women who cannot afford, as I said, to get health care elsewhere.
Talking with Ken Falk, the ACLU legal director for the state of Indiana. Ken, you mentioned earlier in the conversation that if there is legal precedent or legal action to take, what sorts of legal action would there be available to take from the ACLU should the General Assembly vote to ban abortion statewide?
Well, we'll have to see exactly what that means. There still are federal constitutional arguments that could be made. The decision makes it clear that any state law has to be minimally rational, so we'll have to see what the legislature does. It's possible the legislature may go too far and may intrude on other rights, right to travel, right to interstate commerce. I mean, there's a lot to look at, and there are other approaches that have been raised. I know there's a case pending in Florida now where people are arguing this violates religious freedom, a ban would, because the idea that life begins at conception is not shared by all religions. Some religions believe that life does not appear until you obtain your first breath, and therefore to tell them they cannot get an abortion is discriminating against them and their religious beliefs. So there are things that can be done, but obviously we need to see what the legislature is going to do.
Yeah, there's a Jewish synagogue that is challenging the state of Florida for abortion rights access. Ken, I want to thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking. I know that you've got a lot of work ahead of you over the next couple of days, the next couple of weeks. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us.
Well, thank you for talking to me. You take care.
Two sides of the abortion battle collided at the Indiana Capitol this weekend. While thousands protested the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn the constitutional protections for the procedure, others voiced support for Indiana lawmakers to ban abortion during next month's special legislative session. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan was there and brings this report.
Supporters and opponents faced off outside the Indiana State House. Both sides came here to demand what they want next in the wake of the High Court's decision. Thousands of people stood outside the State House as speakers from Planned Parenthood and Women for Change urged them to fight back against the ruling.
Oh, beautiful people who believe in equality.
American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana Executive Director Jane Henniger said this is a first step.
We win when we show up. We win when we stand up for our rights and the rights of others.
Speakers expressed heartbreak and frustration. Lakimba Desatir is state director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. She called on the crowd to show up next month when lawmakers will discuss abortion during a special session at the State House.
I expect to see this whole crowd in this building stack out.
Across the State House campus, a smaller crowd of about 100 abortion opponents gathered. Indianapolis Right to Life President Mark Tuttle says the decision opens a long overdue conversation.
The Supreme Court finally sent it back to the states for us to be able to come together as Hoosiers to really talk about these issues, find out how best to protect innocent human life, as well as be there for the pregnant moms and to support moms in their need.
Abortion opponent Michael Thornsley says he supports a full ban.
I do believe that it should be across the board because even though a woman's life might be at risk, there's still a life there that needs to have a chance to live.
Abortion remains legal in Indiana, but state lawmakers appear poised to restrict it somehow early next month. Governor Eric Holcomb called for a special legislative session to approve a tax rebate. Now he says abortion access should be addressed, too. ACLU's Katie Blair is ready for that discussion.
It's time to dispel the stigma surrounding abortion. It's time to come out of the shadows and have conversations with your neighbors, your friends, and your family. Enough worrying about whether or not talking about abortion will make someone uncomfortable.
Plenty of people were ready to talk about abortion with their personal stories up front. Mary Sturger is in her 70s and from Indianapolis.
My grandmother died from coat hanger abortion that she was forced into by her husband that was running around on her. It's very personal to me.
State House Republicans have yet to say how far they'll try to restrict abortion rights and if they'll allow exceptions, such as in cases of rape. Indianapolis City County Councilor Allie Brown worries about Hoosier women who will be unable to access abortions at all.
So many of us aren't going to be able to, or don't have the money to travel, don't have the means to stay in hotels. don't have the ability to leave and pay for childcare for their current children.
But is compromise possible? It didn't appear so at another rally of abortion rights opponents at the State House. Noah Wyatt is the director of Miriam Pregnancy Counseling Center. He had to speak loudly to be heard over the chanting of abortion rights supporters.
I'm here to rattle the gates of hell with you all as we sing praises to our holy.
Indiana's special legislative session starts July 6th.
We dissent! We dissent!
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. As we continue to hear from leaders from the State House, medical practitioners, as well as activists regarding the recent overturning of Roe v. Wade, we wanted to bring back our conversation recorded earlier this spring in recognition of Black Maternal Health Week. It's important to note that as discussions continue around the debate over abortion rights, experts estimate that a ban on abortions increases maternal mortality by 21%. Health disparities is among the leading causes of maternal mortality, and health plans like CareSource are leading the way in Indiana by putting more focus on Hoosier moms than ever before. Dr. Camula Wright is the Market Chief Medical Officer for CareSource Indiana. She joined us to discuss the latest movement between the local, state, and federal governments, as well as the healthcare industry, to reduce maternal mortality rates. Here's the conversation. Dr. Camula Wright is the Market Chief Medical Officer for CareSource Indiana Market. She joins us to discuss the latest movement between the local, state, and federal government, as well as the healthcare industry, to reduce maternal mortality rates. Dr. Wright, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here today and to speak on this important topic. Thank you.
Black Maternal Health Week is recognized every year to bring awareness and action in improving Black maternal health. Why do you believe it is important to recognize this, especially in communities like Lake County here in Northwest Indiana that have a high population of Black and brown women?
Unfortunately, Black women do not fare as well as their white counterparts in pregnancy. Statistics show that Black women have about a 2.5-fold higher risk of mortality in pregnancy compared to their counterparts. The reasons for this are varied, and they include many of what we call social determinants of health, but there are also some systemic factors, which include systemic racism, lack of representation, and implicit bias in healthcare that really affect not only the likelihood of Black women engaging with the healthcare system, but also their experience when they do engage with the system. And all of these factors really lead to, again, a very dismal outcome for Black women. It's important for us to understand what those factors are and to do what we can to mitigate those factors so that we can really improve the outcomes for Black women and Black babies.
Let's get into the push to teach mothers about advocating for themselves. Giving birth can be overwhelming. I mean, you're dealing with a highly stressful time for the mother, and she is surrounded by a skilled and qualified healthcare team. When you're in the middle of labor, it can be quite intimidating to contradict the advice of the medical provider, even if you know your body and you can sense that something is just not quite right. What advice would you offer for mothers regarding them being able to advocate for themselves?
So there are a few things that I would recommend. First of all, I think that the more educated the mother is in terms of what's normal and what's not normal and what her wishes are during pregnancy and during labor, the better able she'll be to communicate those things to her provider. So I would encourage all women, but particularly Black women who are pregnant, to learn what's normal, what's not normal, to understand what the warning signs are, so that if she is experiencing something that's out of the norm, she'll know to bring that up. The second thing I would encourage is persistence. If there is something that she feels is worrisome or out of the ordinary, she needs to really continually bring this up to her healthcare provider. I think that, as you mentioned, the situation may be intimidating, and that can really discourage someone from speaking up. But what I really want to encourage women to do is to be their own advocate. You know your body best. Don't be afraid to speak up. And the third thing that I would say is have advocates with you. If the father of the baby is involved, have him be your advocate. Have your family there. Have a doula there. Doulas are professional support people who will help prepare you during your pregnancy and accompany you in your labor.
Now, if we can just park on the subject of maternity deserts for a second. Getting around the Hoosier State, particularly in areas like Northwest Indiana, it is nearly impossible to do so without a car. Access to public transportation is very limited, a rideshare service can get costly, and then there are a lot of stressors, including housing instability, economic instability, anxiety, a history of racist policies, and implicit bias. This mix can make up for what could be considered a maternity desert. To that point, what do you say? And how will expectant mothers benefit from services like that of a doula?
So there are a couple things that I would say. Number one, the March of Dimes has designated 33 counties in Indiana as what we call maternal care deserts. And those are areas for which there are no hospitals that provide obstetrical services, and the OB providers are quite limited as well. And we know that all moms, not just Black moms, but any moms living in those areas will have a great deal of trouble accessing care and may have to travel an hour or more to get OB care. And there are a couple of solutions for that. One is your insurance company oftentimes will provide transportation. I work for CareSource. We provide Healthy Indiana Plan and Hoosier Help Wives plans, and we have an unlimited transportation benefit for women who need to get to the doctor's office, who need to get to the WIC office, even food. We have transportation to help offset that so that that is not a barrier for our moms. The second thing that I believe is an option that is underutilized is telemedicine. Many providers will offer the option. There are ways to do that safely in pregnancy, but when you are dealing with someone who is in an area where access to care is not easy, telemedicine is a great option to be able to connect with your provider in a remote setting. I think you mentioned doulas, and there are doulas throughout the state, even in those maternity care deserts, where women can access that will help to, again, make sure that their needs are met and that their voice is heard during pregnancy. There are also organizations like Norse Family Practice and Healthier Moms and Babies that provide home visitation services throughout the state that, again, can help bridge that gap and make sure that women, even in remote or rural settings, are getting the health care that they need.
Dr. Wright, now in your role as the Indiana Market Chief Medical Officer, can you speak to the collaboration your organization CareSource has with the Indiana State Department of Health to combat maternal mortality?
So the Department of Health has been very instrumental in trying to understand why these disparities exist and doing what is within our power to help mitigate these disparities. There is the Indiana Perinatal Quality Improvement Collaborative, of which I participate in, and there are individuals from other managed care entities, from the state, from many community-based organizations, et cetera, that all come together to, number one, understand what the needs are of the community and what the concerns are of the community and what we can do collaboratively to help address those. So we are all actively working together to try to resolve some of these issues.
Thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Joining us now on Regionally Speaking is Indiana Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. Suzanne, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you were just in Northwest Indiana a few days ago meeting with State Representative Mike Andrade from Munster, going over some of the local businesses, specifically Hispanic-owned businesses across Northwest Indiana, including Hammond, Munster, and Merrillville. Lieutenant Governor Crouch, what did you see on your trip up here to Northwest Indiana?
Well, first of all, I just want to say how honored I was that Representative Mike Andrade invited me to come up and meet with some Hispanic business owners. He is the only Hispanic General Assembly member, and it's important that we connect with all people. So I so appreciated the opportunity to come up and to visit and learn more. But we started our tour at the Tortilla Nuevo León with Jaime Martinez and his family members, which have had that business, manufacturing business that makes flour tortilla shell products for since 1975, and they have 25 employees, and was able to sample some of the chips and the tortillas, and I just wish that they actually were able to distribute them in Southwest Indiana, where my hometown of Evansville is, and spoke to him about maybe making some introductions down there, because they were absolutely wonderful. What I liked about the chips were they weren't too salty.
Okay.
And I find a lot of times when you buy chips in the supermarket, they're extremely salty. These were just perfect. So we started with a visit there, and then we went to the Benevente Eye Care and met with Jorge Benevente. Actually had my eyes checked and kind of looked at a few pair of glasses that I might be calling in a prescription for. So that was certainly a pleasant and fun experience. And then we ended up at Katie Rose Boutique, which Monica Branchik owns. And it was really lovely. And she was sharing with me that she does a lot of business because hers is the only kind of clothing boutique that caters to women in that area. And in fact, she did such a good job that I bought an outfit there. So I love the clothes. And, you know, she's a woman, Hispanic woman, that is making a go and being able to provide a service that is much needed up there. And then ended the afternoon with a tour at the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana, and really was so impressed by Victor Garcia's commitment to serving those in need and the work that he is doing there, because they serve over 1,600 seniors, where they give them 50 pounds of groceries. And oftentimes that is a part of the population that we often don't think really have the need for food, but they obviously are serving that need and really providing such great service. And they serve and assisted over 400 residents in applying for SNAP benefits. So it's almost, they do not only food distribution, but they also provide a lot of social services that their clientele may need. And, you know, looking at how they can collaborate and provide partnerships. Actually, in 2021, they distributed nearly 9 million pounds of food. So they are extremely busy. And I think what really touched my heart, it also was very alarming and concerning to me, is they said that they probably only provide about 60% of the need that is there, or they fulfill about 60% of the need that is there. So they constantly are having to turn people away. So I would encourage everyone, not just in Northwest Indiana, but throughout Indiana, to remember that perhaps some of those that live in our little world and don't always think about those who are in need, really give some thought to that and look at how we can be helpful and help contribute to the food banks and the pantries that are serving those in need here in Indiana. But it was a wonderful trip. I met with entrepreneurs that are making a difference and really contributing to the economy here in Indiana and the quality of life that we have.
We're talking with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch here on Regionally Speaking. She recently joined Representative Mike Andrade from Munster to tour businesses across Northwest Indiana, and specifically Hispanic-owned and operated businesses. According to the 2020 census, Indiana's Hispanic population has increased about 42% in the last 10 years. And since 1990, Latino Hoosiers have seen the largest percentage increase in population among any racial or ethnic group in Indianapolis. And by 2030, Indiana's Hispanic population is projected to grow by 284,000 residents across the Hoosier state. Lieutenant Governor, can you talk with me about what Indiana's doing to you know, bring in more Hispanic-owned businesses, not only to Northwest Indiana, but maybe across the state as well?
Well, what we try to do is make Indiana not just a welcoming state, but a state that has an economic environment that allows businesses to grow and prosper. Because quite honestly, when people come here and they locate in our state, and by the way, Indiana, we were the only state to increase our population in the last census. And so that is what we continue to do on a regular basis. And in fact, last week, unrolled and unveiled a campaign that talks about how we can identify Indiana better to those people who live and visit outside of Indiana. And it is the In Indiana campaign. I'm actually on my way up to Michigan City to do an event regarding that. But I think the best thing we can do as leaders of the state is to be sure that we're providing economic opportunity, but that kind of quality of life that is attractive to people that want to come here and settle and live and raise and study and stay.
Lieutenant Governor Crouch, as we kind of make our way through this this current pandemic or post-pandemic, I'm frankly not quite sure where we are with it, other than the cases increase, but deaths are down, hospitalizations seem to be down, which are definitely good things. But how have the local businesses that you've met with and spoke with, how have they managed to get through COVID to keep doors open and, much like the food bank, be able to continue to serve residents of Northwest Indiana?
Well, as I know you probably are aware, we received a lot of federal aid. And with that aid, we were able to provide, through OCRA and other agencies, loans and grants to businesses to keep their doors open. We also worked with groups like people with disabilities and people with mental health challenges to be sure that we were providing grants to them so that they can continue to serve those in need. We also were able to provide grants to those that were festivals, that conduct festivals and fairs and support the arts here in Indiana, because they too suffered. And we wanted to be sure that those things that add to our quality of life were able to survive throughout this very difficult time. So while we have provided the assistance and tried to really do everything we can to keep doors open and to be sure that businesses survive and thrive, unfortunately, not everyone was able to. And, to those individuals, we look to provide opportunities for them to be able to continue to participate in the economy and continue to have jobs and move forward. Because while our economy is certainly growing and we have a 2.2% unemployment rate, we also have 150,000 jobs that are unfilled in Indiana. So the demand is there. If people have a need. Certainly businesses are challenged by, a lack of employees and by supply chain challenges, but we're doing everything we can, from supporting meat processing plants to supporting those in the arts and cultural space, so that Indiana can continue to move forward for Hoosiers and continue to attract population so that we can thrive and provide economic prosperity for all Hoosiers.
And Lieutenant Governor, before we let you go, big news out of the Western, Lafayette, Northwest Indiana, for the sake of this conversation. Soon to be former President Mitch Daniels, and of course, former Governor Mitch Daniels, is stepping down from his role. Talk with us about what that means for you.
I had the honor of serving under Mitch Daniels when he was governor of Indiana. Came in 2005 as a state representative and then became auditor of state in 2013. So I served during his term as governor. And what Governor Daniels did and what his motto was aiming higher. And he ended up leading us on a path to turning this state around, because up until he became governor, we really struggled fiscally. And he was able to tighten our belts as governors. He was able to get us through the 2008-09 recession. He reduced employees, cut government spending, cut taxes. And we ended up balancing budgets and ended up, you know, having healthy surpluses. And as a result, Indiana is number one in the Midwest and sixth in the nation for our business environment. We had the third best infrastructure, and we're one of 13 states with a AAA credit bond rating by all three independent rating agencies. And it all started, that turnaround started under Mitch Daniels. So he was a great governor, and I had the honor to serve under him. And then, of course, he went to Purdue University, my alma mater, boiler up, and, you know, set the bar high, has frozen tuition for all the 10 years he's been there, which has benefited not just those Hoosiers that have attended Purdue University, but I think it has set the standard and benefited students at other universities because he's led by example. And certainly, while I was, you know, I guess, you know, I don't know if upset's the right word. Maybe a little disappointed that he is leaving Purdue. I know he's not. Oh, it's not over for him, and he's going to embark on some other adventure and end up benefiting us as Hoosiers because his chapter hasn't ended yet.
All right, Lieutenant Governor, I have to ask. You don't have to do it on the air, but do you know the words to Hail Purdue?
I did at one time.
as a Purdue grad as well, I would have to cheat and look them up too. Right.
I certainly could get started.
That's all that really matters. Then everybody else kind of takes away the rest of the singing there. We're joined by Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch here on Regionally Speaking. Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us here, and thank you as always for taking time out of your busy schedule to go ahead and inform us as to what's happening not only across the state but right here in Northwest Indiana as you are touring the region. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
As we get ready to celebrate the country's independence on July 4th, we thought this would be a good time to talk about financial independence. The concept of becoming financially independent and retiring early, or the FIRE movement, was becoming popular pre-pandemic, but is it even still possible in 2022? If so, how can one still achieve financial independence and retire early or even on time? Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer with the Hammer Financial Group is here to explain what steps our listeners can implement to retire early if that's your goal. Greg, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
First, Greg, for our listeners who don't know, what does it actually mean to be financially independent? And what specifically is FIRE?
Financial independence is often considered the ability of or the status of not being dependent either on, you know, other individuals, family members, or being in a situation where you still have to continue to work and have a wage, a paycheck, so to speak, to take care of your expenses. And FIRE is, you know, a terminology that is surfaced that's a state of becoming independent and retiring early. And this could be different for every individual. Everybody considers retiring early a different point in their lives, but often it's the 40s or 50s, or, you know, for someone who's an aggressive saver and, you know, has the opportunity to put more money aside, it could potentially be earlier.
Now, Greg, I know many listeners would enjoy achieving financial security, but inflation is hitting us at record levels. How does that affect someone trying to achieve early retirement?
And that's a great question, Dee. You know, some of the inflation that we're hitting today, while we're in the moment, you know, it's kind of hard to anticipate how we're going to look forward and how we're going to be able to retire. But inflation will fluctuate like it has over time. And basically, the key simply would be to have inflation as part of that planning process. You know, you look back, you know, 50 years ago, postage stamp was 8 cents, loaf of bread 25 cents. Be nice to see gas back at 52 cents a gallon.
Absolutely.
And you could buy a car for, you know, just over 3,000. So when you're looking to create that financial independent plan, you need to factor inflation and you need to pick a number that you're comfortable with, not necessarily the number that exists today. And we said the same thing even 5-8 years ago, you know, when there was very little inflation. You still got to factor in what you anticipate it to be on average over your retirement.
I would be happy, Greg, to be honest with you, if gas was at $2.52 a gallon right now. That's how stressed out I am about the cost of gas.
You and I both.
Absolutely. Now, Greg, besides inflation, what other expenses should FIRE savers consider when planning their early retirement?
Well, I think the biggest thing, a lot of people look at a situation where they plan retirement based on expenses. And we like to tell people to plan on based on your lifestyle. you know, the bigger picture of what it takes to do not only pay the bills, but do the things that you want to do in retirement, and most importantly, unexpected expenses, you know, that can cut into retirement savings. And the considerations are very similar when you talk about variables that you can't control, like, you know, what will taxes be? You know, we expect them to be higher. Where are medical costs going to go? Is long-term care a concern? And so most people who are older can reflect when they were in their 20s and 30s and felt healthy, and, you know, the medical problems were an issue. But as you age, and I'm in that situation myself, these other issues tend to pop up where, you know, medical care becomes more prominent. And the big gap when you retire early is the eligibility for Medicare is until age 65. So you have to figure out, where am I going to have that coverage, or how am I going to maintain that coverage until that point?
Right, you're absolutely correct.
Now, what does the process of achieving financial independence typically look like?
And there's a lot of standard numbers. You know, they can throw numbers out like, you know, up to 25 times your salary. With that said, you know, everyone is different and has different goals. And depending on the age that you're targeting to retire, the key is to create a distribution plan. As we rephrase it as an income plan, where you factor in all the things that are specific to you. You know, like I mentioned before, the lifestyle need, you know, other things that you might want to do for personal concerns about inflation, taxes, and it's going to give you a better picture of what that is typically going to look like. But the younger you are, you know, then the more there's a higher probability that you're going to experience more things like market volatility, inflation, increased taxes. So generally speaking, we're going to advocate for those individuals to even exceed the normal saving guideline, because you're talking 35, 40 years instead of 20.
We're speaking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer with the Hammer Financial Group. Now, Greg, for those who want to retire early or even retire on time, what are a few planning considerations they should make despite inflation, supply chain issues, a bear market, and a likely recession?
Yeah, so the news can obviously get anybody frustrated, like you mentioned, even with the gas prices and thinking about retirement savings. But there are some simple steps. One, you know, you just got to target a date. What is that date that I would like to have for retirement? And during the process, we guide people to ask themselves, do you have enough money to support yourself, if you're married, a spouse, for the next 20 years, or in the case of fire, like I mentioned briefly, maybe 30, 40, or 50 years? And the key really is having a plan. A lot of times you get stuck in the moment and we save. But once you analyze your goals and how much money you need to save or invest, there's a couple of different phases. The accumulation phase is pretty straightforward. You know, you're saving as much as you can. And I always tell people there's never too much when it comes to saving. But there are variables that we can't control, like, you know, what is the performance? What is the rate of return? And then most people jump right into that second phase of mentality where they're trying to cut expenses and they're beginning the distribution of those assets. And this is really the difficult phase. You know, the accumulation phase is pretty straightforward. We work hard, we save money, we have time horizons, we're not taking distributions. But the distribution phase is often a lot more complicated. And what most people fail to do is create that preservation stage. And today's environment's a perfect example of why a preservation stage is so critical. If somebody was targeting the retirement of next year and didn't have assets dedicated already for that purpose, well, their retirement date might get kicked back because of the volatility of the market and the assets not being there to take those distributions that they're needing as they move off in retirement. And the obvious thing is try to eliminate debt, right? You don't want to go into retirement with debts, because that's just going to be a constant strain on your assets.
Now, you mentioned setting goals for saving and investing. How should fire savers save and invest?
Well, one principle I always grew up with from the very beginning coming out of college is, you know, pay yourself first. And there's a lot of great vehicles. If you're with a company or an organization that has retirement plans, especially if they're matching dollars, take advantage of those free dollars. And the sooner you get money invested, the better served you are. And I think one of the things that people just got to understand is to say, okay, here's my retirement date. Here's my goal. How can I save this much a month? Well, you start with what you can, and you make efforts to continue to build. So every time that you have the opportunity to bump it up a little bit, boost those retirement savings, you get a raise, pay yourself more. For individuals who want to retire early, it's a matter of, can I save a larger portion of my income? And if eligible, you know, Roths are going to be one of those equalizers for some of those unpredictable events like increasing taxes. And taxes can impact your retirement, because I may have a lot of dollars accumulated, but they're not mine. You know, I have a partner, it's the IRS, where Roth conversions and Roth contributions could help mitigate that potential and what I believe is a likely increase in the expense in the way of taxes.
Now, Greg, I'm going to ask you a question that I'm sure is on the hearts and minds of all of our listening audience. How does a bear market affect those fire savers?
Well, we in our planning process, it's a matter of what your strategy is and understanding truly what your risk tolerance is, because the biggest detriment to most bear markets, and as we tell people, the simple fact of it is markets are going to continue to have good years and they're going to continue to have bad years. But one of the things that you don't want to do is maybe misidentify what your risk tolerance is. And, you know, we often see bear markets where people will pull out of the market, you know, because they're you often hear the phrase of stop the bleeding. And then what happens when the market's low, they pull out, they lose the opportunity to recapture those losses and get back on track to what their investment plan is looking like or their distribution plan. And this is a buying opportunity for the most part. And then diversification. Diversification is the key. You know, other types of investments that are not going to, as we term it, correlate to the market. You know, things that are going to counter a down or bear market that provide value and consistency long term and can provide, as we call it, a less bumpy ride.
So, Greg, I have another question that I'm pretty sure comes up even with your clients at your office. Should someone trying to achieve FIRE get a second job or side hustle to ensure that they just kind of stay on track?
And it's a great question, Dee. And it's really going to be driven by the individual desire and what their priorities are and really what their life situation is. You know, people raising kids, often there's not extra time, right? But anytime. You can, you know, there's two things you can truly control: what's coming in and what's going out, right? As we look to say we want to have a earlier retirement or even a normal retirement for that matter, any additional dollars that we get, you know, part-time freelance jobs that can bring in extra cash, and then of course that key, as I mentioned before, is pay yourself first, right? If I create that extra income, you know, a lot of times the gratification is that, you know, we want to spend it, and that's fine. If you're working a side job because I want to do more while I'm younger, that's great. But if your priority is, in fact, to, you know, try to retire earlier, well, then you need to prioritize where that money coming in is going in terms of investments and strategies to help produce your specific goal, your priority. And if FIRE's that that priority, then you dedicate accordingly.
Absolutely. And finally, Greg, what if someone is listening and they missed the FIRE movement, but they got fired up during our conversation right now and they want to either retire earlier than expected or just want more money to stock away at retirement? What can they do?
Very simple. You know, they have provisions to be able to add more dollars to plans like 401ks and IRAs. If you're over 50, there's bump up maximums with them. There's great strategies that they can do if they've maxed those programs out. There's things that they can prioritize in terms of paying down debt. And again, all of this, Steve, would simply go back to working with a planner, an advisor that is really in tune with how distribution works. You know, there's a lot of great advisors out there, a lot of great wealth managers, but the distribution phase is unique, and it creates and presents new challenges that as an individual or a family, you just haven't been exposed to yet or you're not aware of. And in that phase of life where you're nearing retirement, you need to develop a plan, and you need to understand what that lifestyle need is and what are the things that, you know, I'm not thinking of because I'm entering this new phase, and there's a lot of big decisions, and you want to make sure you're getting the good information to make educated decisions to hopefully create a more predictable outcome.
Greg Hammer is a Northwest Indiana financial advisor with the Hammer Financial Group. Greg, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me on, Dee.
This is Regionally Speaking as we sign off for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. Join us tomorrow as we talk with United States Representative of District 1, Frank Mervan, as well as Purdue University Northwest Professor Frank Colucci on the Constitution and the impact of the overturn on Roe v. Wade.